Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In 1954, in the Brown v. Board of Education decision, the U.S. Supreme Court declared that in public education, separate but equal had no place. And one of the things that the decision did was to help touch off the civil rights movement and end deliberate intentional segregation. However, a lot of people argue that whatever kind of initial gains resulted as far as public schools and minority kids were concerned may well have been lost. In fact, there are people who make the argument that today conditions for minority students in public schools in the United States may well be worse than they were 40 years ago. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Susan Eaton. She's the author of a recently published book that's titled The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and it does a couple of things. It looks generally at the issue of segregation in public education in the United States, looks specifically at one particular school, an elementary school where all the kids are minority kids, that's in Hartford, Connecticut, and also takes a look at a case that has been working its way through the courts now in the state of Connecticut for a number of years, a legal case known as Sheff v. O'Neill, which we will talk about. All of these things, looking at all these things as a way to get at this issue of what's happening in public education, and what are conditions like for minority kids in schools here in the United States. The book is recently published. Certainly you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Our guest, Susan Eaton, is an award-winning journalist who specializes in writing about education. She's former assistant director of the Project on School Desegregation at Harvard, where she received a doctorate in education policy. She's now research director at the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Racial Justice at Harvard Law School. And she's joining us this morning. She's joining us by telephone. She's also written for her work has appeared in a variety of places, including The Nation, The Hartford Current, The Boston Globe, Sunday Magazine, and as well as other publications, both scholarly and popular. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people who are listening, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Ms. Eaton, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. I hope that I got your current title right.
Yep, that's perfect, yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, it was so last minute.
That's fine. We try to get those things right. Believe me, being here at a university, titles and identifications and all that, that's really important. We really want to try to get those things right. So we're really pleased that you could talk with us. The subject is one that certainly we have taken up before on the program. And in fact, it was not all that long ago here on the show. I think it was shortly after the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, just heard the recent cases back in December having to do with efforts to try to achieve racial balance in schools. It wasn't all that long that Gary Orfield actually talked with us here on the program, somebody who's quite well known for having done research on the subject of segregation and its effects for a long time. So just to stipulate to one thing here right up front, we have good research data to show that there, for minority students, there are real benefits that come from attending integrated schools. And I suppose you can argue the other way around, that it's true. That is, it is detrimental for them to attend schools where all the kids are minorities, and for a variety of reasons.
Yes, that's right. I mean, one of the best arguments for racial desegregation or integration is that segregation has never worked well on a variety of measures. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, a high minority school, a school that is majority black or majority Latino, is going to be also a high poverty school. And in terms of achievement, that's where much of the problem comes from. The social problems that overwhelm the school environment that come as a result of concentrating poverty in a handful of schools and school districts.
I suppose that the big one of the big questions is, you know, given the fact that we did have now 50 years ago, we had this very significant Supreme Court decision, and a lot of people at the time, I'm sure, were very optimistic that that would mean big changes and that that things would conditions for minority students and some of the country's most disadvantaged students would improve. The big question now is that why is it now that these many decades later, have the results been so disappointing? And in fact, in recent decades, people are talking about an erosion even of any gains that did come as a result of the decision.
That's right. I mean, the Brown decision needs to be understood is that the Brown decision really was targeted at the South. It was targeted at what we call now de jure segregation. That is segregation that arose as a result of laws that were on the books, explicit laws, racist laws that said blacks must go to school here, whites can go to school wherever they want, as long as the conditions were equal. Now, the whole separate but equal thing was always a sham. The black schools were never equal to the white schools for a variety of reasons. Now, what needs to be understood, too, is that in the Midwest, places like Illinois and Wisconsin, Boston, the Midwest and the North, there really wasn't a huge effort to desegregate the schools there. In some cases, schools were desegregated because school districts were found to be in violation by, for example, rooting black neighborhoods to one place and, you know, establishing bus routes based solely on race. But in a lot of cases, and this is the case of Hartford, Connecticut, and a lot of other communities just like it, there were never racially explicit laws on the books that said blacks and whites can't go to school together. But the segregation that we see was created in large part through a variety of government actions, through zoning laws, local zoning laws, through lending practices that were sanctioned by government, housing laws, federal housing laws that concentrated poverty and concentrated racial groups in one area, by real estate agents, again sanctioned and licensed by state governments, who steered blacks and Latinos, there's plenty of evidence about this, into a handful of neighborhoods. And even in the 60s and 70s, lending practices that made it impossible to buy a home in the suburbs, to buy a house in the city and to get insurance. And that really provided an enormous amount of incentives for white middle-class people to move out of urban areas and to these rapidly developing suburbs. Mm-hmm. A number of factors that led to the kind of racial segregation that we see today. And what this court case tried to do in Connecticut was to find a way to remedy that segregation by claiming that the racial segregation and the concentrated poverty that exists in the Hartford public schools, that condition in and of itself denies students an equal educational opportunity that was guaranteed by the state constitution. Because as a lot of callers may not be aware, and I'm amazed at how shocked audiences are when I talk about this, there is no guarantee in the United States Constitution for an equal educational opportunity.
This, and I think that this here, you certainly make an important point, and one that that perhaps takes us, it takes you almost into another area, because it gets outside of the school and what happens in the school, because you really have to acknowledge the fact that if there is, and indeed there is, segregation in public education, it's because there's segregation in housing. And that a lot of people would say that really that's the place where yes, we can say all kinds of things about the kind of resources that communities have to put behind their students, and there being enormous gulfs in the quality of education that poor kids get and rich kids get. But at the same time, we have to say, but if we, you know, ultimately the solution to that may indeed lie outside the schools, and it really does have to do with where people are able to live and all of the kinds of pressures and constraints that come to bear there.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And in my book, at the end of the book, a lot of people were surprised to find that a lot of the solutions that I talk about are based in housing policy. Right. But one thing that's really important to remember, I mean, here we live in a modern society where overt racism and discrimination have really those things really have improved over time. It's no longer acceptable to hurl racial epithets at people on the streets, and of course we can't have we'd be appalled if some government tried to put a law on the books that said that black people can't congregate here or Latinos can't congregate here. Of course we don't have that sort of thing, but we are still living with the legacy of intentional racial discrimination in our cities. And it's very important to understand that, you know, when you drive around urban areas, you go to an urban area like, say, you know, parts of Chicago, and then you drive out to the suburbs, you see segregation. It just pops out at you. But for some reason, people still tend to think that the reason we have segregation is because black people and poor people all just want to live together, when that's not the case. The causes of segregation go way back, and we're living with those kinds of causes today. But I think also, you're right, the solutions to racial segregation and to concentrated poverty do lie to a large extent in housing. But I think what's also important is that we look at these school district boundary lines that are government creations. And because of the segregation that we have in housing, drawing school district boundary lines along urban and suburban lines, and these demographics were created by racial discrimination, is basically creating, in and of itself, is an act that creates segregation. So I think it's important to think also for governments, for policymakers, and for parents who are interested in sending their kids to racially diverse schools, to think about ways to break down those strict boundary lines. To think about, for example, creating magnet schools where you have children who come not just from one suburb of Chicago, but who come from maybe the city of Chicago and that suburb together in the same environment, in the same learning environment.
Let me just very quickly again introduce our guest, Susan Eaton. She's the author of a recently published book, The Children in Room E4, the subtitle American Education on Trial, that is in part the result of her having spent several years at a school, an elementary school, in Hartford, Connecticut, located in, as she says, in the poorest city in the wealthiest state in the nation. And it serves as a great case study of some of the racial and economic divides that you find in many cities around the United States. The book is recently published, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hills, the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe you might talk a little bit about Simpson-Waverly School and about how it is that you went there in the first place, because it's my understanding that, in fact, when you went there intending to look at it and perhaps to write about it, it wasn't what the book really turned out to be. You went there with a kind of a different idea.
Yes, I did originally. I mean, my feeling was I'm an integrationist to my core, and I believe that integration is the way that we need to go, not just in our public schools, but as a society. I don't really think that we have a choice. But at the same time, I also recognized, and speaking to audiences, I heard time and time again people saying to me, yes, but we have segregation. We need to learn how to make the schools work better within those environments. And I absolutely agree with that, that people, of course, we need people in these segregated environments working their tails off to make the education there as good as they possibly can, because if we just sit around and wait for integration to come along, we're going to be consigning the children in those schools right now to nothing. So what I wanted to do was not do the usual story about the worst segregated urban school that we see done time and time again. I wanted to go to a school that was supposedly working, that I could say some good things about, and that I could say, okay, well, we might not have integration, but here are some possibilities that we see in this environment. Well, this school, Simpson-Waverly, had, in the years preceding my arrival in Hartford, had won an enormous amount of local attention for its anomalously high test scores. So my feeling was, well, let's go see what's happening. Let's go see what they're doing right over there. So I got there and I talked to the principal, who is a wonderful educator and an honest, good person. And he told me that yes, we are doing some things right. We are doing some things better than the rest of the public schools in Hartford, in that we're a smaller school, and I have established an order and a system. And sadly, within that system, what we do is we teach children how to pass the state test, the Connecticut Mastery Test. Now, in the years that went on, and the years that I was there, during this period, the school started to gain even more attention outside of the local area. It started to gain national attention, so much national attention that the U.S. Department of Education under the Bush administration in 2003 came and awarded the school one of their coveted Blue Ribbon Awards, which they hand out to, you know, a handful of schools every year. And Simpson-Waverly was named on the U.S. Department of Education website as a model for urban education. But what I found in that school was actually a mix of the amazing and the appalling. What I found were incredibly talented educators doing their best by these kids, working really hard, but being stultified by a curriculum that wasn't just driven by the state test, but was the state test. The children, oftentimes from 8:30 in the morning until 5 at night, drilled for a state test. They rarely had a social studies curriculum. They rarely had science curriculum. They had no recess. And they had no opportunity, really, outside of the small conversations, the very short conversations that this teacher who I spent time with, this incredibly talented educator, was able to, in her words, sneak in about her travels across the world. And her experiences, were they exposed to anything outside of their small neighborhood?
It seems to me that this is a really important point, because within the conversation we've been having now for I don't know how long about school reform, one of the big buzzwords now for a long time has been accountability. And as a result, that has led in a lot of places to high stakes testing and complaints, the very complaints that you make, and that teachers and administrators voice. And this is the kind of thing that, as after the passage of No Child Left Behind, which has now been around for 5 years, I think that even has made that, it has intensified that conversation, those kinds of concerns, even more. And I would assume that would be something that you would agree with, and that your experience in this particular school would confirm that this having to spend so much time getting kids ready to pass tests, that pass the test. And in fact, you can, as in this case, you can have schools doing well according to the test scores, and they can get all kinds of awards. But that doesn't necessarily mean that these kids are getting a good, well-rounded education, not learning the things that perhaps they should, not learning how to learn, but what they're doing is they're learning how to pass the test.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And one thing that I tried to show with this book was that there is a relationship between the conditions of concentrated poverty and segregation that sound like these abstract things that only academics and civil rights advocates really care about anymore, these things that are from the 60s, right? I wanted to show the relationship between these conditions and what actually happens in the classroom. And there is a relationship. There is a reason why these children in particular are being drilled all day long on these tests. It's because the environment that they're in, and because of all of the social problems that overwhelm this school, one, this school really has to establish order. Otherwise, it's going to teeter toward mayhem. And two, generally speaking, children from these environments have more trouble in school because of a variety of factors that exist outside of school. And so the goal is to basically, and then three, we don't have any real strategy in this country for creating equal educational opportunity. All we have now is the No Child Left Behind Act. And so the only way to create equality that's been given to these educators is to nudge the test scores up, even though the educators know this is not a route to equality. This is all that they've been given. This is all that they have. And so that they're doing the best that they can within this system over which they have very little control and very little freedom. But what's important, and what I realized after being in Simpson-Waverly School day after day after day and watching what was happening, is that I couldn't tell the story of urban education without going to a suburban school. And so I did that. And the differences, I knew that I would find differences there because of my experience as writing about education over 20 years, but it had been years since I had compared the two environments, and the differences are shocking. In the suburban school, I walk in, and there's a line of Spanish words going up the bulletin board because, of course, the children take Spanish. There's a beautiful play area outside. The children have recess twice a day, and they play on a beautiful jungle gym equipment that was raised, and the money was raised, $80,000 was raised by the parents in this middle-class community, and they could create this for the children. The children, 2 to 3 times a week, have social studies. They do a lot of work with maps and geography and learning about different parts of the country, the climate in different parts of the country, for example, and the environment and horticulture in different parts of the country. They have science 2 to 3 times a week. And then in the spring, the teacher explained to me, people from the community come in and they teach elective courses to the children. And so they get to choose between courses like the history of lacrosse or locomotive engineering or conversational French. And so here we have a situation where we've got the urban children who really, to be full participants in this democracy, to be full citizens, really could use a little bit of firsthand knowledge about what life is like outside of their neighborhood, a little bit of exposure to the world beyond the north end of Hartford, and they're getting less and less of it because of the testing requirements. Meanwhile, in the suburbs, the children out there, generally speaking, have much more exposure to life in the larger environment, the larger United States, and they are getting more of it. And so we've got a situation where we are creating even larger disparities between the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, it seems to be a point that comes through very strongly, is that one of the realities of the lives of the children in the school is that they are incredibly isolated,
right?
And that as a result, their exposure to all kinds of things, ideas, experiences that people even middle class people maybe would just really take for granted, it's just not part of these kids' experience.
That's right. It's not, and it needn't have to be that way, because we have, like, for example, the educator that I followed for these years, Lois Luddy, who I write about in my book, and granted, she's an extraordinary educator, and you're not going to find a lot of teachers like her in any environment. She is eager to take these kids, you know, on field trips. She's eager to take these children, for example, for a nature walk in the woods where they could learn about plants. They could learn about lake systems and ponds and wildlife and things like that. She would be excited to do those kinds of things, but she is not able to because of the restrictions.
It doesn't end for the suburban students, the ones that go to, that seem to have so much more. They have so much more. Doesn't the same kind of constraint, the having to take the tests, doesn't that press on them too, or is it somehow different for them?
Oh, it absolutely does press on them. I see it even in my own children. I have two children who go to suburban, racially, and linguistically diverse public schools, but still predominantly middle-class schools. And I see it creeping into their curriculum in ways that disturb me. But at the same time, it doesn't have the same force, and it doesn't completely eclipse and obscure all of the other functions of schools. I mean, I feel like my children in the schools that they attend and in the suburban schools that I've seen are still, for example, able to talk about concepts like citizenship, and they're able to do things in the school that, make the children aware of their role as citizens. My kids learn a lot about, for example, politics and voting. And during Black History Month, they do a lot of work about, they learn about civil rights, they learn about history, and they certainly have very strong science curriculum, for example. And in the suburban schools, even though I hear a lot of grumbling and a lot of annoyance about the level at which the state test has really started to take over, even as early as first and second grade, if you, for example, took away science or took away social studies or took away recess, I mean, it's laughable. It would never happen because the parents would come down on school authorities. The students themselves would come down on school authorities within minutes.
And one, I guess the reason, maybe we should make the point, the reason that that's important is that for the students in this classroom where you spend so much time at Simpson-Waverly Elementary School in Hartford, they don't get recess.
No, they don't. I mean, they could. I mean, that's something that could be very easily changed, and I imagine that as a result of my book,
maybe they're going to get recess now?
I think if one good thing comes out of my book, it may be that the children of Hartford, Connecticut get a mandated recess. And I said that would be a great thing. And this is less about, you know, the benefits of recess than it is about just showing how warped, you know, this has come. I mean, if any child needs recess, needs to run around, it's children in our urban environments who, for a variety of social reasons and social conditions, are much more likely to have health problems, to have, to be overweight, you know, all of those things that we read about. We say, gee, we really should be doing something about this as a nation. Well, how about the fact that the children are sitting in their chairs, you know, 8.5 hours a day and drilling for state tests, and we're not letting them run around?
Yeah, well, I suppose if that happens, the children of Hartford will contribute to it. There'll be a statue of you there to the... And the children of Hartford, because you're the person responsible for them being able to have recess. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be so flippant.
No, I know, but well, sometimes, you know, I was sitting in this classroom and I was watching what was going on. And if you read in my book, I mean, there are moments, I have a great sense of humor, and there are moments of such complete absurdity, the way that these children are being taught and what they're forced to endure, that I kept thinking to myself, you know what, this would be hilarious if it weren't actually happening.
Let me introduce again our guest, Susan Eaton. She is an award-winning journalist who has written a lot about education. She's a former assistant director of the Project on School Desegregation at Harvard, where she received a doctorate in education policy. And right now, she serves as research director at the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. She's the author of a recently published book, The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial, published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. It has some things to say about public education generally, specifically about this school where she spent several years, Simpson Waverly Elementary in Hartford, Connecticut, and also about a case that's been in the courts now there in the state of Connecticut for back since the late 80s, I guess, this case, Chef v. O'Neill. Questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe it'd be good for you to talk a little bit more about Chef, because I know that this is a case that you have been interested in, have been following for a long time, even going back to the time when you were a reporter.
Right. I was a young reporter in Stamford, Connecticut, which is, you know, really in some ways thinks of itself as more of a part of New York than Connecticut. But anyway, the case was filed in 1989, and I was covering education locally in Stamford. And for some reason, the case resonated with me, not just intellectually, but really emotionally. And that's what you know, triggered my, might say, an obsession with the case from the very beginning. Because I think that what I saw in the case was not just a beautiful legal argument, although that existed. You know, all of the intellectual framework was there, and the case was a solid, beautiful example of legal writing, all of those things, and made a very cogent argument about the harms of racial segregation and concentrated poverty. But what I saw in the case at its center was really the American dream, or one of the American dreams, is that, and it was a vision of Connecticut and of the United States in general as a country that really believes in equal educational opportunity, in fairness, and in the idea that we can break down these barriers that were set up between us, not really by our choice, but by many cases business interests and by government action, and that the schools are one place where we can start to do that. So this is a case with a tremendous aspiration to it, and that's what really moved me about the case, and that's what caused me to follow it, really, all these years. And then I vowed. I remember because I was in Stamford and the case didn't seem to have as much relevance for the southwestern part of the state as in the Hartford area, I really wasn't permitted to cover it to the degree that I wanted to, and then to the degree that I kept pushing. And so I'm very stubborn, and so I vowed that I would one day, you know, come back and write about this case.
I wonder if I could ask you about something little off the subject of that particular case and this book, although it's definitely related. And that is the cases, these two cases that were heard by the Supreme Court. This was actually back in December. And
right.
This has to do with the fact that districts, you know, school districts have recognized, and there's good reason to believe, that attending schools that have a kind of a racial balance are good for all students. So then the challenge for a lot of districts is, well, how do you do that? And it seems that in most places what they did was they tried to set up these programs that gave parents choices about where their students would go, and then they tried to create different kinds of schools, different kind of programs to make them attractive enough so parents would look at a particular school within the district and say, I like this particular school, what they're doing, what they teach, their emphasis, whatever, and I want my child to go there. The problem, though, then becomes when you sit down and say, well, we want there to be a kind of a racial balance, so that means we want to set up numbers. We want to have certain numbers of certain kids in the school. And then as far as the people making the complaints in these cases, the problem comes when you say, I want my child to go to school A. And the people there say, no, sorry, we're full up with white kids or black kids or Hispanic kids or whatever. And you don't get that choice. So that's the complaint that these parents in these particular cases, one having to do with Seattle and one having to do with Louisville, are, which then... I hope I'm doing okay with this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which raises this big question of, well, okay, then if you don't, if that's not the way that you're going to do it, if you're going to say rethink racial balance is important, we got to think up some deliberate system to do it, which also sets targets for certain kind of groups of kids. If the court comes along and says no, you can't do that anymore, then what? It seems that then there is no other way to do it. At least I think that's what a lot of people in a lot of school districts are saying. If you're telling us we can't do this, then what do we do?
Yeah, you have crystallized it exactly, and I think that these cases, if indeed the Supreme Court comes down in the way that a lot of people are predicting, I'm holding out some hope for Anthony Kennedy, for Justice Kennedy, to see the light on this issue, but most people are predicting that the Supreme Court will rule against the school districts. And in that case, yes, we have come to the point as a country where we are saying that you cannot, even voluntarily, at the local level, educators, in their wisdom, who have seen over the years the benefits of racial desegregation, are not permitted to voluntarily desegregate their schools because we believe it's more important that everybody gets to go to school exactly where they want, with their exact first choice. No one here is being denied an education. Who is being denied an equal educational opportunity are the students who would, if they didn't have these kinds of plans, would be forced to attend high poverty, racially segregated schools. And you asked, you know, what will these school districts do? It's not clear. And what the civil rights groups, and there was a statement by the Civil Rights Project that was written that was signed by 553 social scientists, their argument is that there is indeed a compelling state interest to use race as a deciding factor because of the proven benefits over time of a racially desegregated schooling experience, not just for racial minority students, poor students, but for white students as well.
Yeah, and just to underscore the point that this why this is so important, or why it potentially is so important, is that many districts around the country, we're not just talking about Seattle and Louisville, we're talking about many districts. No one, in fact, I think even really knows exactly how many have put these kind of plans into place, and this could mean that all over the country, the systems that they have set up, if the court makes that ruling, they will be judged unconstitutional, and they'll have to somehow take those systems apart.
That's correct. They will. Hmm. A lot of districts will probably end up going and using socioeconomic status as a measure so that they don't create schools that are highly concentrated in poverty. But that doesn't, I mean, that's better than nothing, of course. But it's not the perfect solution because it's been shown that it doesn't guarantee that you're going to have a racially diverse learning environment. And also there's just so many more factors, that go into, you know, one's socioeconomic status than income. Mm-hmm. And that's really the only measure that makes sense to use at this point, that's only really sensible to be using.
Well, it sounds like if indeed that happens, then we will in fact be back at that point where you started with, in a sense, with that question, well, okay, so we've got a school here where the population of students is predominantly minority, maybe all minority, and we can't do anything about that. So then the question becomes, what do we do to make this the best school that we can and the educational experience for these children the best that we can? I mean,
right.
Is that really where we end up?
Well, it is where we end up, but the ironic and tragic thing about this is that we are now at the place where things are worse off, at least in terms of jurisprudence, than they were under Plessy v. Ferguson, mm-hmm. which at least said you can have, which permitted racial segregation so long as things were equal. Well, we're not even going to have that guarantee anymore. Civil rights lawyers aren't even going to be able to go into court and say, okay, separate, but things aren't equal. So we're at a situation where things are separate and things are unequal, and there's no guarantee and there's no plan to make them equal other than to get up the test scores.
And that maybe again, I know we're painting with some pretty broad brushes here, but again,
right.
that seems that gets us right, gets us back to Brown and that decision, and that decision of the Supreme Court saying that there was no such thing as separate but equal, that separate could inherently was unequal. So that seems that now, as a result of where we are now, and some more recent decisions, that it seems to stand Brown on its head. Or throw it out the, you know, whatever kind of cliche you want to use.
I like to use flushes it down the toilet or buries it. No, it really does. It makes Brown absolutely powerless and moot.
Yeah.
I mean, Brown was referring to de jure segregation. I mean, that's an important point to make, but that doesn't matter. I mean, a lot of civil rights lawyers say that the word de facto segregation, which is the type of segregation, you know, that we see in, you know, the Chicago metropolitan area, for example, or outside of, you know, Gary, Indiana, all of that, people say, well, that's de facto segregation. And that de facto has come to translate incorrectly into being nobody's fault. It was just this segregation that just sort of happened, and sorry, we didn't, you know, it just sort of happened mysteriously. It's not really anybody's fault, when in fact that's not really the case. That if you look back and you do a very careful study, which is what I tried to do in my book of what really happened in the Hartford region and why segregation was created, and you can do that kind of study in any urban area, any metropolitan area, you see that no, this segregation was created, was decades in the making, and in many cases it was intentional.
We have about 15 minutes, actually more, maybe more like 12 or 13 minutes left in this part of Focus. I just want to, again, introduce our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. Susan Eaton is an award-winning journalist who specializes in education. She's former assistant director of the Project on School Desegregation at Harvard University, where she received a doctorate in education policy. She is now the research director at the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law. She's also done work that has appeared in various places, including The Nation, The Hartford Current, Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and she is the author of the recent book, The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial. It's a subtitle, and Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill is the publisher, and it does a number of things. It takes a look at this particular case that we have talked about, the Schiff case. It takes a look at some of the issues that are at play now in public education here in the United States, and also looks very closely at one school in particular where she spent a number of years. That's the Simpson Waverly Elementary in Hartford, Connecticut. Questions welcome. We do have somebody here who'd like to join in on the conversation. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let us go here to a caller, line one. They're in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you don't mind if I bring up a second-order question. Literally, I can't ask anything about the topic. But
okay.
Program, if the topic resonates with all the people listening, can have the lines filled before it's on the air and during the entirety of the show. I'd like, if you can, to get your guess on why this otherwise really engaged, intelligent, and sophisticated listening group isn't calling in to discuss this with you.
That's a really good question. It's interesting because I think that the issue of racial segregation sounds like an old thing. And I think that, generally speaking, and again, I am painting with a rather broad brush, when we talk about education now, the current discourse that's really set by the U.S. Department of Education and the powerful sort of conservative, in many cases, think tanks and groups, there is no mention of social conditions like segregation and poverty. It's as if all of the inequalities that, you know, we tried to address through the civil rights movement, all of those problems have been solved. That's the way that the debate is going now. And, of course, as we know, all of those problems have not been solved. And in many places in our country, the gap between rich and poor is actually getting bigger. But I don't think that it's something that people want to think about.
That's reasonable as I hear it. My question in part was to ask you, with your better experience and thinking about this, is this a case of over and over again doing things with good intentions that wind up having unexpected consequences? The notion of unexpected consequences has come up in many discussions on this program. People do so much, they hope for so much, only to find that things are going terribly wrong. And after a while, people can get awful discouraged, feeling that no matter what we do, in some way, it won't come up well. Get off and hope you could address that issue of the unintended consequences and whether that's why a lot of people are simply sitting back and not involved.
Yeah, I think that you're right. I think that especially a lot of people within the African-American communities in urban areas have become really disenchanted with the idea of, you know, what was commonly referred to as busing, which, you know, that's not what I'm writing about. And I think that that's absolutely true. And so a lot of times, you know, I hear people in audiences that I go and speak to and say, you know what, I believed in this, and I put my kids on that bus, and they went on that bus, and then all the white people left anyway, and it didn't work out, and it was a waste of my energy to fight for this. And, you know, and I sympathize with that. And now what people are saying in large measure, sometimes when I go to these audiences, is I don't care whether my children are in school with white people. I really don't care. All I care about is the quality of my child's education. And I agree with that. And that's why I went originally into this school saying, okay, let's talk about the quality of education. And what I came out believing and seeing and feeling even stronger than when I went in was that conditions like concentrated poverty, family poverty, racial segregation affect the quality, hamper the quality of a child's education. And so that's the message that I'm hoping to get out, you know, more into the world and inject into the debate and the discourse on public education in general. But I do think you're right. I do think that there is a kind of level of apathy when you start talking about, you know, these kinds of things like segregation and desegregation and structural racism. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me also that what makes dealing with these issues much more difficult is how big they are.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, this is just, we have for a long time had this tendency, if we have identified some problem in society, who do we think ends up having to deal with it? The schools. You know,
yeah.
We dumped an awful lot of stuff on them. And it seems like really some of the fundamental problems we're talking about, if what we're talking about here is institutional racism in the United States, that's way outside of a school problem, and it's a much bigger problem. And you know, if anything's going to make you just sort of throw up your hands and shrug your shoulders and say, well, I don't know what to do about it, you know, it's going to be something like that.
That's absolutely right. That's why I think that we need to pay attention to what's going on in the schools and what's not going on in the schools, but we also have to look at all of the social inequalities and the social conditions that exist outside of these classrooms, the social environment that these children are living in, and we need to, as a society, address those things as well and see them as an integral part of eliminating this persistent thing that we're all worried about called the achievement gap, which is mostly about test scores. We need to say, okay, well, you know what? Maybe the reason schools aren't making much progress on the achievement gap is because a test isn't going to solve all of the social inequalities that exist in our society. Maybe we have to be thinking about this in a much more systematic, much more compassionate, holistic way.
All right. Let's try and talk with some other people here in the time that remains. We have somebody calling on a cell phone, and I believe they're in our line 4 right here. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to hear from you. I agree with a lot of what you say. I got into teaching in the 80s after being in a business occupation for years, and I became a regular education teacher and then decided to try special education. I guess my question would be, in the Hartford school that you attended, did they have a special education population, and how did they work with them if they seem to be specifically orderly working on, you know, the achievement tests? How did they go about dealing with the specific IEP requirements? And that's one of the things. But I quit my teaching area in the 90s when I saw this achievement testing coming on, because I think it's created a real problem for teachers, administrators, and more so the students. But thank you, and I'll keep listening.
All right, well,
thanks
for the call.
Yeah, they had, they had a special education population in this school, sure, and some of the children were mainstreamed into the regular classroom, and some of the children with, you know, more severe handicaps or issues that they were dealing with were taught separately. Sometimes they were pulled out of the mainstream classroom and given, you know, special attention on whatever skills they were working on. And in some cases, the IEP, the individual education plan that's required for special education students to have, were in some cases, you know, they had special accommodations made for them while they were taking the test, but sometimes not. And, you know, this leads to another area, which is a lot of Spanish-speaking children or children for whom English wasn't their first language were required to take the test in English, which seems to me just defies all logic. I mean, yes, of course, every child of an immigrant or Puerto Rican family that comes to the public schools want their children to learn English, but to require them to take the exam in English while not knowing the language seems to be a measure of absolutely nothing and not a measure of what they might be capable of intellectually.
All right, let's talk with someone in Urbana. They're next, line 3 right here. Hello.
Hello, is this me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I think you've made some really good points, Susan and David both. And it is really, really complex and very complicated, and it's really hard for people to understand unless they actually do follow what's going on, especially in the local situation in Champaign. I grew up in Champaign and really, really care about the community. But I guess the points that I want to make are that poverty also influences the way that people learn, and so that even if a teacher thinks that they're teaching to all the students equally in a classroom, it's not necessarily helping the minority students or the students who grew up in a situation that's not middle class and doesn't have a certain, you know, the same learning style as a teacher, because a teacher typically teaches to their own learning style and then sometimes fails to accommodate other learning styles, and especially if that's a poverty learning style, because poverty does influence the way that a person does learn and absorb materials. And I guess the second point that I want to make is, well, okay, so the first point was that teachers don't, even though they think that they're teaching treating all the students equally, they're not treating them all equally. And the second point I want to make is that the school boards really, really need to involve the minority communities in their planning and get the parents involved in the schools for their kids, because that will make the biggest difference in the achievement of the students that are falling behind the most. And I guess I'll stop with those two points, but it's sometimes people don't, especially in Champaign right now, if they're not paying any attention to the things that are going on, don't realize how important it is to educate everybody. And that if they don't, if the investment that they make now in the schools isn't paid, then they will pay a long-term invest, you know, much more later when these people are not educated, and we have to make up for generations that were lost. Okay, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
No, thank you very much. Well, go ahead, Susan.
Yeah, I mean, those are excellent points. So one thing that I wanted to talk about is, yes, absolutely. I mean, we need to have teachers who are trained to, especially if they're, you know, they come from a background that's different from the children whom they're teaching. And I think that there's absolutely a lot of evidence, you know, that there are cultural differences in learning and how you address and how you give orders and how you explain things. But on the other hand, I do want to resist a little bit this notion that these children are so different than, you know, the white middle class children. Because I certainly, and I don't think that's what the caller was necessarily saying, but there is that kind of argument out there that about that. And I think that in some cases, yeah, the styles of speech and of you know, for example, you know, how questions are asked, you know, there are subtle differences, is certainly, but I saw far, 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 far more similarities between the kids in Hartford, Connecticut, who are now on the third generation of racially segregated, economically isolated, living in a racially segregated, economically isolated neighborhood, with middle class suburban kids, then I saw differences.
We're going to have to stop, and I'm sorry to say that we've just used the time, and I really want to recommend to people, if you're interested in reading about what's going on in education these days, this is it's a significant piece of reporting. There's a lot in this book that we really haven't touched on, particularly as a result of all those years that you spent there in the school writing about one classroom in particular and one student in particular. So certainly I would suggest to people, you look at the book, The Children in Room E4, by our guest Susan Eaton, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, the publisher. She is the research director at the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. And Susan Eaton, thanks very much for talking
to us. Well, thank you. It was great.